This is Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Something a little different for you today. We'll talk to an expert forager about taking advantage of what Mother Nature provides without you having to plant it. Sam Thayer is back with us. He's an internationally recognized authority on edible wild plants. He's been teaching classes and workshops around the United States for about 3 decades. His award-winning foraging books include Sam Thayer's Field Guide to Edible Wild Plants of Eastern and Central North America. Hi there, Sam.
Hi, Jill.
So, Sam, I was wondering, how did you acquire your knowledge about foraging? When did that start?
Well, you know, when I was a little kid, I just remembered anything about free food. And so, foraging wasn't that kind of as a name for the topic. That didn't really exist so much when I was a kid, but we had a black walnut tree 2 houses down from us, and my dad showed me that I could eat the black walnuts. And then my grandmother and my grandfather, they had 2 black walnut trees in their yard. So that's one of the first things I learned. And there was a butternut tree across the road in someone else's yard, and I got permission to pick those, and my parents showed me those. So, but I just never forgot those things, and I just built on it. And I was just fascinated. So it was largely self-taught, but I picked it up from people here and there until I was 10. And I discovered this little booklet, Bradford Angier's Guide to How to Live in the Woods. And that had about 40 wild edible plants in it. And I was like, my mind was blown. I was like, wow, this stuff is in a book. And then I started realizing there was other books about it. So I certainly had people I learned from in my childhood. But it was mostly self-taught through books, and I just slowly accumulated it. And I was obsessed. You know, some kids are obsessed with trains, and I was obsessed with, birds and reptiles and amphibians and plants that I could eat especially.
Not the birds and amphibians that you could eat, just the plants?
You can eat some birds and amphibians, right. But I was interested in them because I just was fascinated. I'm still an avid bird watcher,
sure.
And still an avid amphibian watcher and reptile watcher, but the one that ended up being my career, I guess, and the central focus of my life was foraging for plants.
Yeah, because it really has, hasn't it? Now, did you go to school advanced education for this?
I did not. Okay. I mean, I studied botany so earnestly, mm-hmm. as a teenager, but when it came time, I had this dream. I was going to go live off the land, and I worked through high school and saved up money. And so when I was 18, I bought 60 acres, an abandoned dairy farm, and built a little cabin on it. And that was my dream. And I thought, I'll do anything for work to support my addiction to foraging. And so I spent, 10 years working, I would say, lower level jobs in the economy and foraging both, and slowly worked into teaching about it as a profession. It was a gradual process.
I love that. That's a wonderful story. How did your parents react to you running around eating weeds and things?
Well, my mom was very against me collecting mushrooms. Other than morels, because that was the one wild mushroom that she knew. My dad was a little bit, just said, well, I just trust him. Just do whatever you want. But as far as the plants go, my mother was more tolerant of that because her mother foraged a little bit in different wild berries, and I didn't realize till I was an adult how much my grandmother knew. She knew a ton about foraging, but I only saw her about once a year, and she didn't share as much with me. She didn't know that I was so interested, ironically. So my mom allowed me to collect lots of plants kind of at will. She trusted me there, but she didn't trust me with mushrooms until I was about 16.
Well, I think she's justified on that mushroom thing. That's very easy to make mistakes with those. So,
It's a little easier with mushrooms than it is with plants to make mistakes. But somebody with a good head on their shoulders is going to be fine in either realm, as long as they're following the same guidelines of you just eat something when you're absolutely certain, mm-hmm. of its edibility status and of its identity, what it is. So mushrooms are slightly trickier, but anyone with a good head on their shoulders can handle mushrooms too.
Okay, great. Well, we have a call already from Sabi in Middleton. Go ahead with your question.
Yes, good morning. I also learned how to look at these plants and figure out which one was edible from my mother, who also taught me how to cook. She's a Palestinian-born American, and I learned from her everything I know about cooking and foraging for things. Porcelain, or purslane, depending on how you read it and pronounce it, is a succulent that is prevalent here in Wisconsin. People eradicate, fight it, and try to kill it. It is a delicious succulent that is relatively undiscovered here in the U.S., and it has a lot of omega-3 fatty acids, and it's really, really good for you if you know how to cook it. So I hope that that was included in your work. And if you know anything about purslane, you know, when I share with the listeners, it's P-U-R-S-L-A-N, I believe. So our dandelions that are eradicated and fought vehemently, my neighbors look at my lawn full of dandelion, and they accuse me of letting the seeds fly everywhere. But if you pluck those in the right time of year, you don't even have to go look for those. They're everywhere. And if you pick them just the right amount and you know how to take the bitterness out and saute them, they make a delicious vegan, vegetarian, or dishes with meat.
Okay. Go ahead,
well,
Sam.
I'm glad that our caller brought up two of my favorite wild edibles. So as far as purslane, that is one of the most widespread native plants in the world. For many years, it was believed that purslane was not native to North America, that it was brought by Europeans. But then archaeologists started finding purslane in archaeological sites and realized, no, this is native here also. So that's a common disturbance-dependent plant and with a fascinating life history. It's that, you know, small plant likes garden soils, disturbed soils, especially where it's sandy with the thick, succulent leaves. And purslane photosynthesizes partly through what they call crassulaic acid metabolism, where it stores, it creates crassulaic acid during the day, and then it converts that to sugar at night, because in doing that, it loses less moisture. So it's a very, it's adapted to high moisture stress, high temperatures and low soil moisture. And it's all over the world. It's native to Australia, Africa, Asia, Europe, in the Americas, and high in iron, and just an incredibly easy plant to work with. So if you look online, you can find tons of recipes for purslane, and it's incredibly easy to identify. So that's a great starter plant for people, because many people have it in their yard, and you don't have to go far to find it generally. Most gardeners are already quite familiar with it. Easy to incorporate into your diet. But it's a hot weather plant. We won't see it appearing in Wisconsin usually until late May, and in some places not till mid-June, because it doesn't like it until it gets at least about 75 degrees out, maybe 80. And dandelion, well, dandelion season is right now.
Yes.
And you know, they're not blooming yet here in northern Wisconsin, but they are in southern Wisconsin. And one thing we do with dandelions is before they bloom, and the flower buds are clustered at the base, right at ground level, and a lot of people don't notice the dandelions at this time, but we'll take a spoon and gouge out this whole cluster of dandelions, and it's like an artichoke. And the thing is, we can return to the same dandelion plants year after year. A lot of people don't realize that a dandelion plant can live for a century. I mean, there's ones we've been gouging out for 15 years.
Wow.
And you gouge out those flower buds, and then we steam them, and just, I mean, they're just this mild artichoke-like vegetable, with artichoke with this faint, you know, lettuce-y bitterness, but it's faint and pleasant. Oh, I mean, I love those dandelion hearts. We call them the gougers. And then shortly after that, we'll harvest the leaves. Now, the key to having dandelion leaves be fantastic as a vegetable, I think there's three key things. One is get them when they're young before the dandelions bloom. And not so much for flavor, but for texture, because when the leaf is still expanding, it's extra tender. The flavor is better, but the texture is much better. The second thing is I don't pick the base of the dandelion leaf. So I use scissors and I cut it. I take the outer two-thirds and I leave the base. So people talk about the bitterness in dandelion leaves, and before you're accustomed to that bitter flavor, It's off-putting to some people, but it's faint in the spring, and the strongest bitterness is in the base of the leaf, so I take the outer part of the leaf. And then the other one is so many traditional dandelion recipes from around the world, fry dandelion, and it could be with olive oil, plant oil, and very often it's with pork. You know, dandelions, onions, and bacon go together. And you know, if you have a healthy source of bacon, that's a really healthy way to cook dandelions. So I love dandelion greens, young ones in the spring, fried with onions and maybe a few other greens. If you've tried them and you didn't like them, but you didn't do it in early spring like that, and you didn't fry them, try them again.
Now, that's key to a lot of the plants you forage, is you have to pick them at the right time.
Yeah, and a lot of people don't realize that we have bred our domestic vegetables to hold themselves in this kind of peak form. So like a head of lettuce, a wild lettuce plant forms a head just like a domestic lettuce head. But the domestic holds that head for like a longer time. The wild lettuce is only in this head form for like 3 to 5 days. And if you don't get it that window, boom, you missed it. But the other side of that coin is the wild lettuce is actually better at that point because it's not artificially kind of bred to hold itself there. So you get a better head of lettuce if you identify wild lettuce at the perfect time. It's better than any romaine. That's specifically our Canada lettuce or Lactuca canadensis, or what in our house we call the good lettuce. that one is better than any romaine you can buy if you hit it just right. So a lot of these wild things, the timing is really, really critical.
Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of thing that you can look up, like in one of your books or other sources. They'll tell you when to pick it, right?
Well, I try to go into detail for all that stuff in my books because mm-hmm. one of the things that frustrated me as a young forager is I would be told, you can eat wild lettuce. Oh, boy, how many times did I have to try it before I found a way that I liked it? And I realized, okay, it's safe anytime. But if I want one of my friends to share it or my mom to be willing to eat a bite, you know, I need to make this good. So I had to figure out what's the right time and also what's the right species. There's actually sometimes it's complicated. We have 6 or 7 wild lettuces in Wisconsin, and 2 of them are very good and 2 are pretty good, and the others are not really very good. So there's stuff to figure out to get the culinarily the best experience.
We're talking with Sam Thayer, an internationally recognized authority on edible wild plants.
WPR connects you to people in Wisconsin and around the world. You hear many perspectives and civil conversations every day, and you may even learn a few things along the way. Wisconsin Public Radio brings you thoughtful conversations and the latest news. Thanks for listening.
Support for WPR comes from the state of Wisconsin, business sponsors, and tens of thousands of supporters who contribute. Thank you to everyone who makes WPR possible on air, on the app, and at WPR.org.
And this is Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nadeau. Right now we are talking about foraging. Sam, it seems like the interest in foraging has kind of increased quite a bit in the last decade or so. Have you seen that?
It really seems to. And it seemed to start around the Great Recession, 2008, 2009, a strong rekindling of interest in foraging. And then it was got another boost with COVID and all outdoor activities kind of. There was a lot more attention for that summer. Everything outdoors was crowded. But there does seem to have been a steady increase. There's been an increased perception that food is important. You know, we have the slow food movement and organic food movement. And this is kind of part of that, like return to our roots. Like we have enough food now. Let's look for the best food.
No, I love that. I love that. Well, let's go to the phones because we have Nettie in Fond du Lac who has a comment about a couple of wild edibles. Go ahead, Nettie.
Hi, Sam. I am hoping someday to come up and take classes with you, but your story sounds just like mine. I'm 75, though, and I had no way of learning except, on my own. Then I met Grandmother Kiwetinokwe, and a ton from her, especially, the importance of learning to connect with the plants and to listen to them. Are you safe to listen to? But the ones that I would really like to talk about, first of all, is stinging nettles. And there are many varieties of stinging nettles. The ones that are really good to eat are the Urtica dioica. Those are the ones with the great big heart-shaped leaves. And oh my gosh, I can pick them without getting, barehanded, but that's a trick to that. The other ones, the little sword-shaped ones, those are so fibrous that it's really not the best idea to.
Oh, I think we lost her. I'm sorry, Nettie. Maybe you can call back and we can finish up with that. But comments, Sam?
Well, I love you listeners. nettles, again, one of my absolute favorite plants. And one thing that's great about nettles is I have a garden, my wife and I have a garden, and we very much love our garden. But you get some spring things that come up so fast, and, they're just waiting. And stinging nettles are a frost-resistant plant. They can freeze solid, and they're just fine. And, this rich, hearty flavor and this really high-protein green that's extremely digestible, and it just feels so wholesome. It's one of the things I can't wait for in the spring. Stinging nettles, you can make soup out of them. You can saute them. We'll just steam nettles and just sprinkle them with salt and a little butter. And they're just so great and wholesome by themselves. There's a million recipes that you can find online for stinging nettles. And it sounds like Nettie was describing two species of nettle common in Wisconsin that sting, the wood nettle and stinging nettle, both of which are native. The wood nettle is the broader heart-shaped leaf, and I, like Nettie, prefer that one very much. It's more tender than the classic stinging nettle, which is also found in Europe. The wood nettle is only in North America, so we have better nettles in Europe. The stinging nettle, you have to be more careful to get it smaller and younger so that it's more tender. The wood nettle is tender, longer, and at a larger size. But I think they're both excellent.
Okay.
The wood nettle will come up a little later. It's not frost resistant like the stinging nettle.
Okay.
But both of them are ideal in the spring. But you can use the greens later in the growing season. When the plants start flowering, the greens get kind of a gritty texture. And I'll use them for tea at that time, but I'm not going to use them as greens once they have flowers on them.
Okay. Now, the other thing that Nettie wanted to bring up was chickweed. Do you use that?
Oh, yeah. Now, chickweed is excellent. And like nettles, chickweed is a group. So we have at least four or five native chickweeds in Wisconsin, or chickweeds, some of which are native and some of which are not. And every one of them is good. They range from good to also very good. And we have a small native one called stitchwort that has a square stem and paired leaves that is a very cold-resistant native chickweed, and it's perennial. And if you find a carpet of that, I just cut them with scissors. And chickweeds all have a flavor that reminds me of fresh corn silk, like if you took the corn silk and ate it when the corn wasn't quite ripe. And I really like that flavor. Then we have common chickweed, which is mostly in urban areas and gardens, and plant likes cool weather, and you'll see that peaks probably mid-May, great salad plant. All the chickweeds are great salad plants. You can cook them, but they're so dainty, they almost disappear. And then we have one called water chickweed, which is probably the most common chickweed in Wisconsin that foragers collect, and that's the largest of our chickweeds, and it's really common in the driftless area and in most of southern Wisconsin in, slightly sunny forest edges and openings. And that was the one that, when I lived in the Madison area, I collected a lot as a teenager, the water chickweed. So all chickweeds, and I can't teach you to identify them over the phone, but they all have a flower with white petals, five white petals, but each one is split in two, so it looks like 10. So when you see that pattern, there's a very good chance you have a chickweed, and they're a pretty easy group to recognize.
Okay. Let's go back to the phone then. Suzanne in Black Creek, what do you have for us?
Thank you for taking my call. I was just wondering, in regards to the wet lettuce, I'm looking to use it for pain relief, and I was wondering if that's best orally, or can use it orally and topically, and is it just best I could dry it, or do I, you know, make it into a tea right away? Could you explain maybe some of that for me, please?
Okay, so I'm not an expert on the medicinal use of the plant, but I will tell you what I know about this. I do have a friend who has a severe chronic injury that he takes lettuce, wild lettuce, makes his own extract as pain relief. And he uses the prickly wild lettuce, which is one of our non-native lettuces, and it's one of the more strongly flavored ones. He uses that in the midsummer when it's mature. And then he cooks it down and makes some sort of concentrate with it. I can't give you all the details on that. The problem is I eat every day, so I know a lot more about food than medicine, which I don't use nearly as often. but I would say that would be a good starting point, and there's some fairly good instructions online for it. And the lettuces that I find the best for food are the ones that are least used medicinally, which makes sense because the medicinal components tend to be associated with the stronger flavors and the plants at maturity. But that prickly wild lettuce should be easy for you to find almost anywhere in Wisconsin, and it has a prickly base to the leaf, which is very distinct, and a prickly stem. And I won't go further into details that I don't know and mislead you, but that plant, I would say midsummer, and make sure you use preferentially that lettuce as opposed to the other ones.
Okay. Thank you, Susan. We appreciate that call. David Appleton, you're up next. Go right ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Very interesting program. So I'm wondering if you can eat Creeping Charlie or Creeping Jenny, and how about Ramp? It's a type of wild onion. And please, there's two more, hostas and daylilies.
Okay. Well, I'll save the Ramp for last.
Okay.
and I will say Creeping Charlie is edible. It's a mint family plant. It's mostly used as a flavoring, not so much as an ingredient you would use in any significant amount. I think that I scared away a friend in sixth grade by cooking something with way too much Creeping Charlie in it. and so something to be aware of, it is a strong flavor. And it's not my favorite flavor now that I know a lot more foraged flavors. I have a friend in France who adores that plant and uses it a lot in cooking, and has made drinks with it that she has served to me that I thought were excellent, and I would not have conceived of that use of the flavor. So think of that Creeping Charlie as a flavoring plant more than as a food plant, but perfectly safe, and it's a strange mint. Think of it that way. And then hostas. Hostas aren't wild. Hosta young tender greens are edible. I've eaten them a few times. But I don't have hostas in my yard, and so I have not used them extensively. Ellen Zakos is a great foraging author that has a backyard foraging book with a more extensive chapter on using hostas for food, and she's also a great cook, so that might be a place to look there. There's one more he mentioned that I forgot.
Daylilies.
Okay, daylilies are a very controversial wild edible. They're very known. Well, they're very well known as a wild edible. They also make some people have gastric upset or diarrhea. And so there are different varieties and hybrids of daylilies, and some of them are apparently not safe. So I grew up eating daylilies without any problems. But there are people who get sick when they eat daylilies, and this is in my foraging workshops, I do not allow participants to eat daylilies. Because I know eventually somebody will get sick from it. I know other older, more seasoned foraging authors who've told me when I was starting out, don't let people eat daylily in your classes, you know, and I think that was wise. So I eat them with no problem, just the common orange daylily. My favorite part is the flower I'll saute the flowers, and I feed that to my family. We've never had a problem. But I go to the same patches again and again. But any weird-looking daylily that looks anything other than the normal common orange daylily, I would shy away from that, and I would just recognize that some people get ill from daylilies. And finally, he mentioned ramps,
yes,
which is something I was wanted to talk about. So ramps are a native wild onion, and they are very common in Wisconsin. Not everywhere in Wisconsin, but generally statewide, they're common. This is a great wild edible, and I have lots of them on my property, and we eat them on a regular basis. So the name ramps, it comes from there's a European wild onion that's ecologically fairly similar that is called ramson in England. We dropped the second syllable here, but we named our very similar wild onion ramps, also called wild leeks by a lot of people in Wisconsin. And there is a fairly vigorous online debate. This is a controversial wild edible because some people say it's not sustainable to harvest ramps. There are places where people are unsustainably over-harvesting wild ramps from public land. And that needs to stop, and it should not be happening, as with any other over-harvesting. But someone who is a responsible harvester of ramps and follows some basic guidelines, which is, you know, when I harvest a ramp patch, I will take about half of what's there every 4 or 5 years. And I've been harvesting from the same patches for decades, and I watch, right? And how much you can harvest depends on a number of factors, such as what is the competition. I know where I have a lot of trout lily or Pennsylvania sedge with my ramps, for example, two common plants that grow with it. They'll prevent the ramp regeneration. I can't harvest as much in those places, or I'll actually pull out some of my Pennsylvania sedges to allow the ramps to regenerate. So there's a lot to consider there, but it can definitely be done sustainably harvesting. And I guess when I say 50%, I'm harvesting whole plants, bulbs and tops included, which is how ramps are generally traditionally harvested. But you can also harvest just the leaves. When you harvest just the leaves, you prevent the plant from flowering over the long term. If you do it 1 year, you won't. But if you harvest, you know, leaves year after year, but you generally won't eliminate your patch. So I recommend with either one, harvesting leaves or harvesting bulbs, do it judiciously. Don't take all that's there, and keep your eye on your patch where you're harvesting. And also do things to promote your ramps. I will grab some seeds and plant them in a new location that looks like just the right habitat, but there's none there. And I'm positive that I account for many, many times more ramps existing than I have, you know, eaten in my life. So it's something that you can do sustainably. And when you find a good ramp patch, cherish it, because it's just a great early spring vegetable, extremely nutritious, extremely tender. And, you know, it's an oniony green. It's not as strong as chives. And there's some volume there. And so it's really kind of hearty. You can, you know, we will fry ramps and then have them with duck eggs in the morning, for example. And we love that. We make ramp soup. We'll put them in stir fry with lots of different vegetables. I'll put a ramp leaf on a sandwich or a couple ramp leaves. I don't ferment ramps, but I have a friend who does, who gives me a jar every now and then. They're fantastic. There's so many things you can do with it.
Yeah, wild leeks are, well, I grew up calling them wild leeks, but ramps, but they're wonderful. We use them all the time in the spring. So, yeah, what a great, and you do research on them, don't you? I noticed that on your website.
Yeah, so we have, this is the 18th year since I put in my first research plot, and I have an area in my sugar bush where I make maple syrup. It used to be dominated by hemlocks. The hemlocks were cut out. The maples have taken over. And things like ramps and these forest understory plants, they move slowly. So I had a big area that was good ramp habitat with no ramps in it. So I thought, here's a perfect opportunity for me to plant ramps and then monitor their growth rates. And this has kind of ballooned into a whole bunch of different experiments and just observational studies. I need to get these finished and get them published, but I'm like, each year I'm like, wow, new data. So what I found is I put in 85 bulbs. This will be the 18th year. I'm going to have about 3,500 plants from the original 85. So about in 18 years in my first study plot. And what I found is the competition makes a big difference in how fast they reproduce. And what I found is the soil disturbance of harvest really helps the seed germinate. So if you have a good patch and you harvest it, but not over harvest it, it creates ideal opportunities for germination for new seeds. And the harvested patches produce a lot more seeds and flowers than the unharvested patches, because like anything in your garden, you know, if it's too dense, it's not going to thrive and it's not going to produce much fruit. So those are kind of the basic takeaways from the research I've done.
And if you want to check that out, Sam's website is called foragersharvest.com. Lots of info there. And there's a whole page of stuff on ramps. So if you're interested, you can delve deep into that one. So thanks for the comment, Dave. Let's go to Jeff in Evansville. Go ahead, Jeff.
Hey, how you doing this morning?
Great. Thanks for the call.
So I've been marching around outside, and I located my stinging nettle. I've got a little thing that I do in my greenhouse where I spread my compost in December and then put the covers on my cold frames in there and water them real good. And I've been eating lamb's quarters for about almost a month now. So tonight I'm going to make a lamb's quarters and stinging nettle sag paneer. I've also got some mustards that got away from me that I'm going to go through and clip too. And I'll tell you what, it is delicious.
That sounds great, and I'm excited for you. I'm actually coming to southern Wisconsin today, and I'm hoping I can get some greens ahead of what we have up north and bring them home and make some big green-based dishes. And I love what you said. Is it Jeff?
Yes.
The caller, in that you know, people often think of like foraging and gardening as if they're opposed. And that's really kind of a strange new idea. I mean, historically, all over the world, almost every society, there were people gardened and people farmed, small-scale farming. People combine foraging and gardening, and they get the best of both worlds. You know, you don't forage out of an emergency because you're starving. I mean, you could, but most foraging that takes place is because it gives people the best combination of food, and it increases the diversity of what you can eat. And you know, we think of foraging sometimes as like emergency food, but it's also gourmet food. I mean, maple syrup, ramps, these are things that you'd pay a lot of money for if you bought. You get to have the best food in the world for free if you have a little bit of knowledge by both gardening and foraging.
Okay, thank you, Jeff. Appreciate that. Enjoy your meal this evening. That brings me to one question that we may want to talk about, in that if you're foraging in your backyard or, you know, near where people might be treating lawns, you have to be pretty careful, don't you?
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought that up, because I'm kind of excited, and I would have just talked about all the plants I'm excited about and forgot this basic detail. People often think of misidentifying plants as like the biggest fear of foraging, but people have really good common sense and very rarely eat something they haven't identified well. I mean, those kind of poisons are exceptionally rare. But the bigger fear that I tell beginning foragers about, and that I certainly worry about more myself, is making sure that you are not eating plants sprayed with herbicide. And one of the hardest parts about this is that our cultural relationship to herbicide is changing. We use it way more now than we did 30 years ago. And 70 years ago, it was hardly being used. And so we don't have a good set of cultural norms around herbicide use, or and I can't give you a rule for foraging to how you know something hasn't been sprayed with herbicide, except know the spot you forage from. I'm lucky that I forage on my own land, or I have, you know, neighbors. But in the national forest, for example, if you're going to go pick blueberries, and if they're going to spray herbicide in an area, you know, where there might be blueberry pickers, they're generally going to post that. And but we're having some faith here that it hasn't been sprayed without being posted. So that's my biggest fear. I wish I could tell your listeners there's this one rule. But you need to just use common sense in assessing where people may or may not have sprayed. And when in doubt, don't eat or ask, you know, someone.
Sure. We're talking with Sam Thayer, an internationally recognized authority on edible wild plants. And this is Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nadeau. We're talking about foraging. Sam, we did have a call from Bob who couldn't stay with us, and he says that he knows that you love wild plums, and he wants to know when is the best time to harvest them.
Okay, well, we have two species of native wild plum in Wisconsin. We have the American plum and the Canada plum. They're both statewide, but the Canada plum is much more common in the north. And the Canada plum, now, I'm just going to just say, imagine Wausau or the center of the state for these times I'm giving. And then if you're in the far north, you're going to add a week and a half to that. If you're in the far south, you're going to subtract a week and a half. But the Canada plum, say at Wausau latitude, is going to ripen generally about August 15th to 20th. And the season is not, you know, it's fairly long, but it's not a long season like apple season. There's about a 2 week period. And then the American plum, the peak ripening is about September 1st, maybe August 25th, a little bit later. The American plum has a thicker skin and very juicy inside. The Canadian plum has a thin skin and a pulpier inside, but they both make delicious jams and jellies, and we do canned plums. I take my lightest maple syrup, and then I mix it 50-50 with water, and then I use that as like the liquid. You know, I pour over in between the plums, so I water bath can wild plums that way. Then I let it sit for like 6 months, and we pull these canned plums out, and we eat them like as a dessert, but then we save that liquid, and we use it to flavor fizzy water, and it's this beautiful, pink, delicious plum fizzy water. So in our house, it's a regular thing. You know, once a week or more, we'll say, hey, let's open a plum fizzy at dinner tonight. I love them that way. They make good fruit leather. Mm. But the plum pulp itself is sour enough that as straight-up fruit leather, it's a little too strong. So we mix it at like one-quarter plum or one-third plum, and then the rest applesauce to make fruit leather, great fruit leather. But the best thing is at plum season, peak season, when they're totally ripe, where you just touch them and they fall off, or if you accidentally bump a bush, there's like 35 fall on the ground right away. They're just so juicy inside. And, you know, we call it sucking plum nectar. We'll just go out to our fence line where we have some great wild plums, and we'll just bite it and suck the juice out. And you know what? Just toss that seed. The flying squirrels eat the seeds. The mice eat the seeds. And we'll just gorge on plums until we're sick of them. So it's just a great wild edible.
I love it. Oh, I'm going to be looking for one of those because that sounds delicious.
And you know, they're found statewide. And almost every city has plum thickets in the city, in a park. You know, along road shoulders. I mean, you find them anywhere statewide.
How big does the fruit get?
Oh, well, that's a great question. So they're quite variable. And if you find one wild plum doesn't taste good to you and you know it's ripe, try another. They're like apples. They're highly variable. The best ones are like an inch and a half, inch and three quarters in diameter. Actually, I'm in Eau Claire right now, and there's one near Eau Claire, east of town. I'm not going to say exactly where, a few miles. There's this along the road, there's this plum patch. Oh, they're just giant, and they're delicious. The bigger ones are like a typical domestic plum, but some of them are as small as like, you know, 5/8 of an inch, but I ignore those small ones. The average one's about an inch diameter.
Okay. Yeah, they're pretty small. Good to know.
They're pretty small, but boy, they're loaded, they are loaded. I mean, you can fill a 5-gallon bucket in a matter of 10 minutes when they're loaded.
Nice. Well, let's go back to the phones. We have a few more people waiting here. Rachel in Whitewater, go right ahead.
Hi. Thank you for answering all of our questions. You were talking about creeping Charlie and daylilies, and creeping Charlie doesn't taste good. Stay away from daylilies if you're new to foraging. What would you recommend as some plant to eat to get used to the different taste profile when foraging, so it doesn't turn people away and you can kind of build up that acquired taste?
Sure. Well, I would say that each plant is its own acquired skill and its own acquired taste. So I'm not saying beginners should stay away from daylily. I'm saying anybody with whom it disagrees should stay away. And so think of foraging not as a skill you learn. Think of it as like this kind of umbrella term, and each individual plant is its own skill. Because I could name most people wild edible plants that they already like, say red raspberry, black cap raspberries. You know, most people know those and like them, wild blueberries. And so just that idea helps people get over the idea that wild foods have strong or aversive flavors. Every flavor is kind of scary to people when it's brand new, no matter what it is. But so some of the most mildly flavored plants, like I call them gateway wild edibles. One of them that I like to recommend for people is thistle stalks. The hard part about a thistle stalk is that people tend to get them too late in the season when they're very young. There's something magical that happens when you take this plant that's essentially a weapon, and then you turn it into a vegetable. And now somebody like my brother that just doesn't like vegetables is not going to be really into a thistle stalk. But most people that like vegetables, I mean, you peel a thistle stalk at the right time, I don't care how you cook it, like, you know, people are going to like it. It's just incredibly mild and easy to eat. There's nothing objectionable about it. So when I do beginner workshops with foraging, and it's the time of year when I can peel a thistle and share it with people, that's like my go-to thing. I'm like, just wait till you see this. The world is going to seem magical. We mentioned earlier chickweed. That's a great one. It's mild. Another one coming up soon is basswood leaves. Right after the buds open, basswoods are so common, and it's just such a mild leafy green. And then again, like I mentioned, all these different wild berries, you know, there's the very well-known ones. There's some that are less well-known. But, you know, you make something good with wild berries, and people are not going to find that objectionable. So there's a lot of good gateway plants. You don't have to focus on these strong-flavored plants. But give those strong flavored plants a few shots. You know, there's people grow up, kids don't like beer the first few times they taste it. And then a lot of people grow up to like beer. Strong flavors take a longer time for people to grow to like them, but then they often grow to very much like strong flavors, like chocolate, all sorts of different strong things. So there's both kind of wild plants.
Okay. Well, thank you, Rachel. Appreciate that question. Let's go to Cater in Herbster. Go ahead, Cater.
Hey, Sam.
Hey, Cater.
I missed the first part of your talk because I was out roaming around, so you may have covered this, but just wondered if you're seeing anything drastic happening to the health of plant populations or phenologies due to climate change?
You know, I would say not. I would say that there are years who have been exceptionally early, a few exceptionally late years also recently. But one thing that I try to keep in mind is the plants have been here a long time through climate changes that weren't necessarily as volatile as what we're seeing now, but really great differences in climate. And most of them have broad ranges. And what was fascinating about last winter being incredibly mild was to watch how the plants reacted to a mild winter. We're used to ramps, for example, emerging as soon as the ground thaws or the snow melts. But last year, when the ground didn't freeze and there was no snow in most of the state, the ramps just waited. So interesting to see them behave that way, how they might behave like Kentucky in a much warmer climate. So it seems that they have the inherent ability to handle these fluctuations. But overall, I would say it doesn't seem to have a dramatic negative impact on the plants in general. But certainly like last winter, not this most recent one, but the one before, that was amazing to watch because none of us in northern Wisconsin have ever seen a winter that mild. And certainly the plants, they had to fall back on their ancient adaptations to handle totally different weather, you know, abnormal weather.
Okay, thank you so much, Cater. I appreciate that call. Now, in the last 3 minutes or so that we have, I know we wanted to talk a little bit about some of the restrictions and things that are happening. Now, Nicole Inshano emailed us, and she's wondering about these things, too. As more people go out and forage, how is this going to affect, you know, nature, plants, animals, et cetera? And is there a worry that public lands will be destroyed? So what's going on with Minnesota, because they've been doing some things, haven't they?
Well, Minnesota has some proposed legislation for foraging regulations on state land, and I've been in contact with the people on the foraging side of that issue regularly, and it appears those regulations are probably not going to pass. I feel like this is something that societally we need to deal with. So foraging has not been highly regulated except for the things for which there's a lot of pressure, right? And so the two things that you need a license to forage in Wisconsin are ginseng and wild rice. And I am fully in support of all necessary conservation measures and beyond what most people are thinking, not just conservation, but how do we take care of all these plants? And I think we need more people foraging so that we have people paying attention to the plants, and it's the foragers who speak up for the plants. It was wild rice harvesters that, you know, protected wild rice when it was intentionally being systematically eliminated from most of the lakes in the state 70 years ago. And it was wild rice harvesters who stopped that from happening. And so I think we need people foraging to be the eyes and the ears for the plants that we care about, because when you eat something, you experience gratitude, and you really become the protector, the caretaker. That being said, there's always irresponsible people out there, and we need a way to deal with that. And I would advise against over-regulation, regulations that don't need to exist. And I'll say, for example, I hunt snowshoe hares. For snowshoe hare hunting in Wisconsin, there's no limit in the number that you can shoot, and there's no limit to the season. And that's because it's an abundant animal in comparison to the number of people who want to harvest it. And that's the case with most of our wild edibles. You know, nettles are not under pressure, you know, of being eliminated.
No.
Ramps are not under pressure of being eliminated, even though some people are making that claim. They are becoming more abundant, not less abundant, over the last decades. And so I think we need to pinpoint the things that need protection and not create unnecessary regulation. And that's how we manage our wildlife and our fish. And that's how we should manage our plants also. But I do think the conversation needs to happen, and foragers need to take an active part in that, so that it's not regulated by people that have no stake in it, which is kind of what almost happened in Minnesota. It's a very interesting process here. And I think those of us who forage need to really ask ourselves, what do we want and what do we need, and become involved in the process of creating those regulations. I think we have very reasonable regulations in our state parks and forests. For example, Wisconsin, we can collect berries, fruits, nuts, mushrooms for personal consumption. I don't think there's any reason people should be commercially harvesting anything on public lands. Not that it necessarily shouldn't ever happen either, but I'm comfortable with that. In our national forests, my family picks blueberries and service berries every year in the national forest, a lot that we eat, and it's not under heavy pressure. I mean, last year we had a spot, there was a mile, there was tons of blueberries.
Okay. Wonderful. Well, we love your enthusiasm, Sam. It's catching. So thank you so much for being back with us again. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me.
You bet. So Sam Thayer is our guest today. If you want to find out more about his books, he's got a DVD, he teaches classes, go to foragersharvest.com.
Thank you. chocolate.
Johnny and the Raindrops, a song. I like chocolate. That's the song to get us going today on this hour of our program as we visit with Rowan Jacobson, an award-winning journalist who writes about science and nature for publications like the New York Times, Scientific American, and Outside. He is the author of 8 books, and his latest is a dandy. It's titled Wild Chocolate, Across the Americas in Search of Cacao's Soul. It's out from Bloomsbury Publishing, and I finished reading it a couple of days ago and really enjoyed it. What makes some chocolate better than other chocolate, perhaps? Is chocolate like fine wine or a good cigar? Do you have to be an expert to know the difference? Rowan Jacobson, welcome. Thank you for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
Hey, Larry. Great to be here.
Your new book, which is really a dandy, it's about fine chocolate that's come to prominence in the late 1990s, early 2000s. It's about the people who make it possible. And so there's a fine chocolate focus, but also we get a look at history. We get a look at some adventures by the people who were really responsible for bringing this fine chocolate to the forefront. It reminds me at times of an Indiana Jones kind of saga. I mean, it's filled with just fascinating information about chocolate, and so I can see why you'd be interested. But what set you off on this journey to find the source of wild cacao?
Yeah, well, like you were saying, Larry, it was when the chocolate bars started getting a lot better in like the 1990s, 2000s, and you know, I'm a longtime food writer, so yeah. I wanted to know why were they better, like what was making them better. And so my initial interest was in following that back to the beginning, you know. But then as you, like, it got complicated. The Indiana Jones stuff started to pop up unexpectedly, you know.
Oh, and it makes it really a lot of fun to read. Chocolate, I have never asked a person, do you like chocolate, and have them say, well, no, I hate chocolate. Everybody seems to love chocolate. A lot of it, though, that's consumed today it's mass processed and comes from perhaps what you might call inferior cacao beans.
Yeah, inferior beans, and also grown. You know, the industry, you know, engages in practices that aren't that ethical sometimes, and when how they're sourcing those beans and how they're treating the people who are growing them. So that was one of the big interests to me, is this new chocolate and new ways of producing it solves a lot of those problems and actually can be really beneficial for the people and the environment.
You know, when I grew up, the only way I've ever heard it pronounced was cocoa.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You actually addressed the pronunciation of cacao and cocoa and chocolate.
Yeah, totally, because it's everyone's confused by it, and it's more complicated than it needs to be. Like the real short version is like the Maya, the ancient Maya, they pretty much created chocolate, the culture of making it, and they called it like cacao or cacaoa. And so then that became cacao, and then the Spanish sort of called it cacao, but then once the British got involved, you know, they wanted to say it in a way that sounded more comfortable for English, so they changed it to cocoa. So it's now cocoa in, like, you know, the big industry calls it cocoa and cocoa beans. And back in the Americas where it started, they still call it cacao. And then the word chocolate comes from, it originally meant, it was the Maya word that meant cacao water, because they always had it as a drink rather than as a solid thing. So cacao-otl meant cacao water, but then we turned it into chocolate.
Yeah, and that's been going on for 4,000 years, and it was primarily consumed as a drink?
Yeah, and still is in a lot of Latin America. But yeah, the Maya were definitely drinking it and using it for ceremonies 4,000 years ago. And some people in Ecuador were using it more like 5,000 years ago, and we don't know what they were doing with it, but we've found traces in pottery and stuff like that.
And chocolate itself is, you write about this, is very chemically complex. The number of flavor, aroma and flavor compounds is, I don't remember now, over 700, I think I remember.
Yeah, it is. It's hundreds and hundreds, and it's just like a really complex substance. And you know it when you taste it, right? It's got the rich, you know, buttery elements, and it's got bitter elements, and it can taste almost like nutty and toasty. It's just an incredibly complicated food, and the pharmacological compounds are complicated too. It gives you a good little rush, you know.
It does indeed. Well, as we said, the 90s, late 1990s, early 2000s, the European chocolate makers were sourcing cacao beans from all over the world. And maybe you could explain the importance of terroir.
I mean,
it's something we normally think about relating to wine, as you point out in the book, but talk about the importance of terroir.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's a word that comes from the wine industry, and usually it's a French word, gets translated as the taste of place. And it's in wine, they talk about terroir to explain why, you know, a Chardonnay grape in one spot in, say, Burgundy will produce a very different tasting wine than a Chardonnay grape in California, right? It's the terroir. It's the way the environment changes the flavor of the thing. Same thing is true in chocolate. And it's partly has to do with the environment, but also partly with the genetics, the strain of cacao that you use. And basically, you mentioned earlier that a lot of the chocolate that we eat, especially if it's, you know, what's in the candy aisle at the grocery store, is produced from beans that aren't very good. Those cocoa beans were chosen because they produce a lot. The trees produce a ton of beans rather than because they have a great flavor. So the ones with great flavor are kind of back in the Americas where cacao originated, and they don't produce nearly as much yield, but they have all those great flavor compounds that we like.
Yeah, and a lot of the sort of mass-produced comes from Africa, does it not?
Yeah, so even though it's native to the Americas, when chocolate became like a big worldwide product in the 1700s and 1800s, they started planting it in Africa because it was cheaper to produce it there. The labor was cheaper, the farms were cheaper. And still today, about 70% of all the world's chocolate comes from Western Africa.
But the good stuff comes from Central and South America.
Yeah, so the stuff that for thousands of years people were using because it tasted so great kind of got left behind when the industry became, a big commodity. And only recently, when people started really caring a lot about the flavor in chocolate, did they get rediscovered. So they're still kind of hanging out in the jungle, these old varieties that taste really unusual and delicious. So that's where the Indiana Jones part comes in, because you have to go find them. And then people are trying to do that now.
Yeah. And there at one point, as you know, there was an idea that there was no more wild chocolate anywhere.
That's how this started for me. Is I found out about this bar that claimed to be made with wild cacao from the Amazon in Bolivia, and people were skeptical. Everyone thought that the wild stuff had disappeared a long time ago. But this one German guy who was sourcing these beans in Bolivia, he was on these online forums saying, no, it's wild. Really, it is. Like, no one believes me. So I got in touch with him and said, like, is it really wild? He said, yeah, come check it out. I have to go get some more. I have to do this expedition. You can come. So I, not thinking about it too hard, said, sure.
Victor Lehman was his name. And he was an interesting guy. I could tell the little background on him. He was a forester or some training in forestry, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, yeah. He likes to grow things, trees and other tropical crops. He's German, but he'd lived in the Amazon for a long time doing development work, basically trying to figure out ways that the people there could make a living off the standing forest so they wouldn't cut it down for cattle ranches, which is the big problem the Amazon faces. So he was always looking at what crops could grow in the forest, in the shade of the forest, and actually produce something. And he discovered this wild cacao there that loves to be in the shade of the forest. That's where it naturally grows. And no one had ever thought it tasted good because it hadn't been treated well. It was often rotted in while people were trying to dry it. So he improved the sort of harvesting production of it, and it turned out it was incredibly delicious. So this is that bar that made a big splash in the early 2000s, and I tasted.
Yeah, and I'd like to taste. I haven't had that chance yet. But maybe at this point, it would be worth it to talk about what happens to that bean and what needs to happen and what he discovered. And, you know, he did some trial and error as well.
Years of trial and error, yeah. And this is the nerdy part.
Yeah, like, but it's like, really interesting to me.
Yeah, as I was working on the book, I was like, I can't believe I'm going to write half a book about fermentation. But that's the gist of it is, to make beautiful chocolate, you have to take those beans through a pretty complicated process, this like chemical process. So the beans grow in these pods on these little trees called cacao trees. And you open up the pod, it looks almost like a squash. And inside are the beans covered in this sweet pulp. And so if you just took those beans and dried them and ground them into chocolate, they wouldn't taste very good at all. They would just kind of taste astringent and bitter. So what you have to do is let that pulp that's there ferment on the beans. So it's almost like making wine or something where you put them all in a box or a vat and let all the pulp ferment into alcohol. And then that alcohol turns into acids, acetic acids, which is the natural, that happens with, you know, with wine and vinegar the same way. As that's happening, all those alcohols and acids actually soak into the beans and break apart the cells in the beans and trigger this molecular chain reaction, which produces the chocolate flavors. And we have no idea who figured that out first or how long it took them. It obviously probably happened over hundreds or thousands of years. But that you have to do all that, and then you have to dry the beans. And you have to do all that in a very humid rainforest without letting it rot. So you can't let the fermentation go too far, but you have to let it go far enough. So it's this really controlled process that you have to get right if you want to have the best chocolate.
Yeah, it's an amazing process. Of course, you go into it a little more. And you do it in a very entertaining way. You describe this whole process through the eyes of people who are actually doing it and teaching others how to do it, which I found really fascinating. Shanna in Stevens Point has a question for you, so let's go there. Hi, Shanna.
Hi, it's Shana, actually, but that's okay. My daughter, sometimes she'll eat different kinds of chocolate bars, and some of them, she says, burns the back of her throat, while some of them don't. So I'm just wondering if that's like a quality thing or if it's a certain ingredient that maybe it's an allergy or what could be up with that.
Yeah.
My guess would be that it's the astringency. Like chocolate naturally has this astringency in it. How old is she?
She's 15.
Oh, okay. She's pretty old. Yeah, I think it's just like, yeah, there's this natural, like almost like if you have oversteeped tea or oversteeped coffee, there's this, astringency in chocolate that's natural. If you're getting the more expensive chocolate and the one that has a higher cocoa content to it, then that's probably going to be more pronounced. That'd be my guess.
Yeah, that could well be the case. Shana, thank you very much for calling. A listener emailed to ask, what are the health benefits of dark chocolate versus milk chocolate? Which brand makes the best dark chocolate?
So all chocolate is good for you. It's got a lot of different antioxidants in it. So the same reason that's good to eat nuts and fruits and vegetables, chocolate's like a very concentrated form of that. But dark chocolate, you know, milk chocolate is the same as dark chocolate, except it's diluted with milk, with powdered milk. So you're going to have less chocolate in there and more milk. And often milk chocolate has more sugar as well, not always. So dark chocolate is just going to be more concentrated. And you can, most of the good chocolates now, they list their cacao content right on the label. So you like milk chocolate might be 30% or 40% chocolate, cocoa. And dark chocolate's going to be, you know, 65 to 85% cocoa. So it's just going to have a lot more of the stuff in there.
Yeah. And we've got other callers coming in. But just a reminder, we're visiting today with Rowan Jacobson. He has a dandy new book out. It's titled Wild Chocolate Across the Americas in Search of Cacao's Soul. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking today with Rowan Jacobson about his book titled Wild Chocolate Across the Americas in Search of Cacao's Soul. Great to have him with us today. And several questions and emails coming in. David Appleton has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Dave.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So can a person go out and find these wild seeds, bring them home, and grow as many as they want without domesticating them, kind of like an heirloom seed? The heirloom seed stays the same variety and everything. Would that work? And also, when you make the chocolate, is the process the same with all chocolate, or is it different with wild beans?
Hmm. Hey, really good questions. Let me take that second one first. Yeah, all chocolate is made in kind of the same way. Once you've dried those beans, you just grind them up and add sugar. And, you know, if you've ever been to Mexico, you'll see these little patties of chocolate for sale in the markets that are ground like just by hand or in very basic machines. So they'll be really grainy, but like the really smooth chocolate that we tend to like, it's just the machines can grind it really, really fine, but it's just chocolate and sugar and, you know, whatever, sometimes they'll add other ingredients like vanilla, but that's it. Just grind. It's almost like making peanut butter in a sense. And in terms of growing them, yeah, you can take the seeds from a pod and plant them and new trees will pop up and pretty fast because it's the tropics. In just a few years, they'll start to produce their own pods. Of course, you have to be in the tropics. It's not going to work in Wisconsin. cocoa trees, they like it really warm and moist. They can only grow about 20 degrees on either side of the equator.
And Victor Lehman, who we were talking about earlier, just a really such an interesting character anyway, who just got, deeply in love with the wild trees that he found, cacao trees, and he bought, I think, 13,000 acres for $10,000.
Yeah,
his whole savings.
Right, only in Bolivia can you get away with that, you know.
And grew. He was looking for the wild, but he was able to take some wild and grow them up as trees.
Right. These old varieties that have been out there forever, literally, you know, millions of years, probably, you can plant them just like the caller was asking and get your own cacao forest.
Nina and Menasha, we'll go to you next. Hi, Nina.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Good morning. I'm so excited that you have this guest on because I'm a foodie. My family here are foodies, and we've taken trips to Oaxaca, Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I witnessed the mole and the Dia de los Muertos, which is Day of the Dead, November 2nd of every year. I was there for the celebrations, and they have like little booths where the indigenous people would bring baskets of their family recipes, and then they purchase by the kilo these toasted and roasted cacao beans, and then they mix it all together. They pour it all in, and it comes out like a paste. But I just wanted to tell people that if they can get a hold of Mayo Dormo, it's brand chocolate from Oaxaca, Mexico. It's the best I've ever had, and I've had a lot of chocolate.
Well, what do you think, Rowan?
Oh, yeah. Well, you nailed it. Oaxaca is one of the world's great chocolate hotspots. Part of my book is set there. And, like every family has their own recipe for making these mole sauces, which usually have cacao as one of the ingredients in them. Mm-hmm. You can also buy chocolate drinks for sale on the street corners. Little old ladies like ladling out their own special recipe for a chocolate drink. And Mayo Dormo is this bigger company that has a few spots in Oaxaca City. And they've got these great old machines that must date from the early 1900s that they use to grind the chocolate on premises. And they make all these drinks and hard chocolates. So yeah, Oaxaca is a super concentrated collection of heirloom cacaos and cacao recipes. And if you go out into the countryside, you can actually find some growing still.
Yeah. Thank you, Nina, for calling. And Amy in Door County, your turn. Hi, Amy.
Hi. Gosh, I hate to have to be the one to bring it up. I was hoping somebody else would, especially right next to all those lovely, charming village-type stories, which I'm sure are a totally different scenario. But don't we have to talk about, is it true about there being child slavery involved in the production of chocolate?
Amy, thanks. Go ahead, Ron.
Yeah, that's really important to talk about. And it's another thing I talk about in the book. This is a problem that's been argued about for decades. And the gist of it is that, like I mentioned, most of the cacao in the world is being grown in Africa by farmers who are very poor. It's crazy. They make about 78 cents a day for producing cacao. And that's for their whole family, right? So the prices for cacao have always been so low that the farmers have very little money. And so then what they end up doing is their children work for free. And because this part of Africa also has a lot of unrest, civil wars, and countries that are basically falling apart. So there's also a lot of refugees. And so refugees turn up on these cacao farms and you end up working for free in exchange for a place to live. So it's just really, rough conditions, but it all comes down to the incredibly low prices that the industry pays for cocoa. So these farmers can't really make a go of it, and they end up getting their kids to work for free. So for 20 years ago, the U.S. government actually threatened to slap labels on chocolate products, like certifying that they either were or weren't made with child labor. And of course, the industry freaked out and hired Bob Dole and I forget a couple other like very prominent ex-senators to lobby hard to make sure that didn't happen. But in response, as a deal, they agreed to get child labor out of the chocolate trade by 5 years. And that was in 2001. They didn't make it. So in 2005, they said, all right, we're trying. Let's push it to 2010. 2010, they couldn't do it either. They said, how about 2020? 2020, they kind of admitted that they couldn't even trace where most of their cocoa beans were coming from. So they're still working on it. They have made some progress, but still a huge problem. And it goes back to price. Like cocoa is a commodity, like oil or soybeans or whatever else. So the prices go up and down, but it's bought by traders who are driving a very, very hard bargain. And there's so many different middlemen from those fields in Africa to the coast, to ships that ship it to Europe and the US, to the people who actually grind the cacao and then sell it to, the big players like Hershey's. So with that many middlemen, that's why so little money makes it back to the farmers. So what has to happen is more money needs to make it to those into the hands of those farmers And the industry needs to step up to make sure that no kids are getting pulled in anymore.
And when it comes to the fine chocolates, there are some women who have played an important role in helping, at least in Central America and South America, to get more money to those farmers, at the same time making some money themselves. And the one woman I really wanted you to talk about was Emily Stone. And maybe just give the background. You're giving some of the background because in I think it was Hershey that pulled out of the this area and left farmers high and dry who were trying to do organic chocolate. Well, you tell that story.
Yeah, exactly. So one of the solutions to this whole problem is to cut out all those middlemen and just establish relationships that are more direct, where the chocolate makers are buying the beans directly from the farmers. So a lot more money can go to the farmers. And so there's more of a relationship rather than just like this commodity game. So because that ends up being a lot easier in Latin America for various reasons. So this new wave of chocolate makers who want to make their own chocolate straight from the beans, they've all gone to Latin America to try to establish relationships with the farmers. And so Emily Stone was this woman who in 2010, I believe, she was an activist. She'd worked with Greenpeace. She was part of a campaign to try to get Hershey's to get child labor out of their supply chain. But then she decided she wanted to be participate more directly. So she went to Belize in 2010 and just started meeting with the cocoa farmers down there and saying to them, you know, like, can I just buy beans directly from you? And you can skip this whole commodity process, because they were still selling. They were selling for a very low price at the time. So she set up these fermentation and drying facilities so that they could improve the quality of their cocoa so they could get a higher price. And then she set up arrangements with chocolate makers in the U.S. so that the beans would be shipped directly to the chocolate makers. And the chocolate makers agreed to pay higher prices, partly because the quality was good and partly because they wanted to help out the farmers. And so then she developed this company called Uncommon Cacao that has become sort of the main middleman for fine chocolate, that finds these really great beans in the Americas and sells them directly to these small, what are called bean to bar chocolate makers in the US. And this has really changed the game. So a lot more money for the farmers, a lot better quality chocolate. So everybody's happier on both ends. And that's a lot of my book focuses on this sort of completely separate system for producing and supplying chocolate.
And she had to do a bit of educating on her own, if I'm not mistaken, of educating farmers on, you know, how to prepare and have those beans properly processed and so forth and dried.
Yeah, and that was the key. Like they kind of knew how to make it good, but one of the things that's hard for us, I think, in the U.S. to wrap our heads around is like how little these farmers have to work with. Like none of them have vehicles usually. It's really, you know, like developing world conditions. So their houses are pretty simple. They get around on foot or by bus. So, you know, say you're a farmer, you've got all these cocoa beans. Even if you manage to, you know, successfully ferment and dry them with your very limited infrastructure, what happens then? In Belize, there used to be, there was one buying station. So all the farmers had to carry, you know, hundreds of kilos of beans that they had just dried onto a bus with them and travel to the buying station and hope the buying station was open, because it was only open like once or twice a week. And hope that they were buying that day and would buy the beans. Otherwise, they would have to haul them all back on the bus. So insane system, and like you can see why it basically wasn't working. So what Emily Stone did at the age of 25 when she arrived was to create this whole new this centralized facility called Maya Mountain Cacao that would buy, would prompt, guarantee to buy all of the beans from these farmers, and in fact would send a truck around to pick them up. So it's just, it's like a simple solution like that makes all the difference to these farmers in some of these very poor places. So the quality was good. The farmers, it was much easier for the farmers. So then more and more people started farming cacao in the area. And Belize has now become like a leader in fine chocolate.
Yeah, it has indeed. And she had her own troubles. You know, we haven't talked at all about coyotes, what they called coyotes, who were kind of mad about the fact that she was buying up, these were guys who were going around and just picking up the pods or the beans and giving nothing or very little for that. And here she was coming in and promising higher money, more money.
Yeah, one of the things that really surprised me was how often the chocolate trade intersects with crime, with organized crime in these places that tend to be fairly lawless places, whether it's a drug trade or just like, you know, everyday crime. But yeah, so these farmers who had no way to sell their beans and had no vehicles before someone like Maya Mountain was sending a truck around, their coyotes are these, people in Latin America who do have maybe a vehicle and will just go town to town buying whatever farmers are producing for incredibly low amounts of money because they know they're the only game in town. So they'll be like, oh, you got some corn, you got some cacao, you know, I'll give you a buck for it. And often farmers were just forced to take it. So Emily and Maya Mountain Cacao basically started shouldering those coyotes out of the game by offering much higher prices and more convenience, first in Belize and then in Guatemala. And now Uncommon Cacao operates in a number of different countries. But not surprisingly, the coyotes were not thrilled to be losing. So there's been guns, there's been threats, there's been machetes. That's just constantly part of the simmering background of chocolate production, you know?
Yeah. Rana in Lake Halley has a question about some combinations of cacao and other things. Let's go there. Hi, Ron. Rana.
Hi, Larry. Hello to your guest. I've read your articles many times in Scientific American, and I'm very excited to listen to your talk today. Two questions is, what would you recommend for a good cacao and dried pepper combination to drink? You know, a dried pepper with capsaicin, not black pepper, that wouldn't light my mouth on fire. And then the second one is, from the Jack Nicholson movie, Cocopelli. Is that actually real? I'll take my answers off the air. Thank you so much.
I don't know that Jack Nicholson movie, so you'll have to fill me in on that one.
I don't either. But what about the other part of the question?
Oh, so all right. So for chocolate, I would send anyone who wants to check out some of these really great chocolates. There's a website called Caputo's, and Caputo's is the primary importer of fine chocolate in the U.S. And so they have all the good stuff on their site. And then I believe the chocolate ships for free. That selection, you can't go wrong. Just look for any of the drinking chocolates or the sipping chocolates, because those will come in small bits that are really easy to dissolve in hot water. And some of them do have spice in them. There's a shop in New Hampshire called Dancing Lion Chocolate. This guy he was a nuclear physicist who became a chocolate maker. And he takes his chocolate craft about as seriously as he took nuclear physics. So he does some amazing products, and he sells an incredible drinking chocolate. He's got two of them. One is spicy and one is not spicy. So you could go for either one.
I have the fortune. In Madison, we have some chocolatiers, some very good ones. And I have the advantage of living a five-minute or a little less than five-minute walk from Gail Ambrosius, chocolatier.
Oh, yeah.
Who was named one of the 10 best chocolatiers in North America.
Yeah, no, you're sitting pretty there.
And she always has some chocolate, liquid chocolate that you can just taste when you come in the store or in her shop. And she is one of the people who I think probably has benefited a lot from the work that was done by the gal that we were talking about earlier, whose name's Emily Stone, because she works Gail, for example, works directly with farmers, has been there, actually lived on the farms, has spent time on the farms, and uses single source chocolate for a lot of hers.
Yeah, no, she's well known in the industry, and she's very representative of this new wave of chocolatiers who are really partnering with the farmers in a way that never used to happen in the old days.
Yeah, talking today with Rowan Jacobson, and we have some more callers online. We have some email questions. His book, take a look at it. It's titled "Wild Chocolate: Across the Americas in Search of Cacao's Soul." I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.
Support for WPR comes from the state of Wisconsin, business sponsors, and tens of thousands of supporters who contribute. Thank you to everyone who makes WPR possible on air, on the app, and at WPR.org.
Our guest today, Rowan Jacobson, his book titled Wild Chocolate, and let's take a call from Kathy in Harshaw, Wisconsin. Kathy, hi, thanks for calling.
Hi. I tuned in late, so I don't know if you've discussed Fortunato chocolate or seen the book on finding Fortunato. So the fellow says that they found a rare chocolate that they thought had gone extinct. It was the national white cacao bean. They found it in a remote canyon in Peru. And it was at small farmers. I guess it was a chocolate that was preferred by nobility in Europe when they were first invaded by the Europeans. And they thought it had gone extinct. But they found it in a small farm. And they said the secret of it was it was a mixture of many fruit trees and nut trees, and that the roots kind of intermingle and they absorb some of the qualities of those trees. I didn't know if you'd already discussed this or not.
Well, we certainly have talked a bit about the wild trees and people thinking they were extinct. But what about this particular white bean?
Yeah, Fortunato is it's another one of the famous ones. It's one of the ones I mentioned in the book, and it's a great story where it was back in the 1700s. It was the pride of Ecuador, and all their chocolate was made with it. And it did have most cacao beans are purple, and that purple the bitterness compounds are in the purple. So since ancient times, people have looked for trees that produced whiter beans because they didn't have that bitterness in them. And back in the day, they didn't have any sugar, so they were drinking it unsweetened. So you really wanted to get that bitterness out if you could. So the white beans were really prized. And then, of course, as I was saying earlier, it became a big industry worldwide. They weren't so worried about flavor. So these beautiful white bean varieties got forgotten and left to the jungle. And everyone thought they were extinct, but they are being found more and more. And Peru and Ecuador are two of the hot spots that probably have more than anywhere else. That Fortunato was literally this, like, it really was like Indiana Jones, where it was this valley that was really hard to get to. And the trees had just been growing there for centuries. And then these guys that were working with a local mining operation found them and thought they were weird looking and had heard that white beans were were prized and everyone was looking for them. So they brought them to the industry, brought them to some cocoa experts. And the experts were like, oh my God, where did you guys get this? And so now they're back, and you can find those on the Caputo site too.
Yeah, and Matt, you have a piece on Matt, stories relating to Matt Caputo in your book.
Yeah, so he's been an important player who is just really passionate about about helping the farmers and bringing some of these really unusual tastes back into circulation so people can experience them.
Rick in Sturgeon Bay, what's on your mind?
Oh, hello, Larry, and thank you for taking my call. I worked for many years with the Mescalero people in eastern Honduras in an area known as La Mosquitia. Two groups have just recently begun cacao operations, hoping to generate some income for them locally. They're both along the Patuca River, which apparently is a good site for growing cacao. But they're relatively inexperienced, as am I. And so I have two questions. One, where might we be able to contact someone who could give us some expertise about growing, cultivating cacao? And then the second one would be, where could we look for someone here in the States that might be interested in buying the cacao once it starts producing?
Hmm. Yeah, really great questions, and that's amazing. That's fascinating. Those are also good cacao operation, good cacao places. I would recommend reaching out to a group called the Heirloom Cacao Preservation Fund. This is a nonprofit that focuses on bringing back these old varieties, and they'd be a great first point of contact. You can find their website quite easily. It's hcpcacao.org, I think, and so they can help connect you with people who are interested. And they also, you can actually submit your beans for heirloom designation through them. And so then they work with a lot of chocolate makers to connect chocolate makers and chocolate growers. So that'd be a good place to start.
Yeah, and maybe talk a bit more about that foundation, because that's in and of itself an interesting story that you write about.
Yeah, and it actually started with that that Fortunato, that cacao from Ecuador. That was when people started realizing, like, oh wow, there are amazing flavors of cacao to be found in the American tropics, but they're disappearing, right? Because nobody's been using these for sometimes two or three centuries. The trees will get cut down eventually, or the forests will get cleared. So suddenly, everyone realized time was tight, and somebody had to really be more actively going out there and finding these things. So it's kind of like Indiana Jones, only instead of golden idols, you're trying to find these golden pods of cacao. So Heirloom Cacao Preservation Fund was a partnership between the USDA and the Fine Chocolate Industry Association. And so what they do is they actually reach out to farmers who aren't getting recognition for their beans, but might have really unusual beans with unique genetics. And so the farmers submit a few kilos of beans, and then the beans are ground in, made into a chocolate by Guittard Chocolate Company in San Francisco, but blind. Like nobody participating knows where the sample came from. They just make it into a chocolate with their standard recipe. And then there's a tasting panel that also blind tastes each submission, and the ones that get scored really high get designated as heirlooms. And then they do genetic testing to find out what the background of the beans is. And then they have a whole ceremony, and they announce the new heirloom designees. And usually that generates a lot of interest from chocolate makers and working with those beans.
Yeah. The Heirloom Cacao Preservation Fund, for our earlier caller, in case he missed the name of it, a place to go online and take a look, and you'll maybe get some help there. Rex in Madison has a question. Hi, Rex.
Hi, Larry. Hey, I have a question. Every morning I do a shot of instant coffee and a double shot of cacao powder, like what we would call hot cacao, and I'm concerned about how much lead is in the cacao powder that we buy here.
That was a question Stan in Madison had also wondered about, lead and cadmium content of cacao in South America sources.
Yeah, that is definitely a question. Consumer Reports did a test of a year ago, I think, or maybe a little more, and found across the board, a lot of chocolate samples were high in cadmium and lead. How much of a problem is that? And I've looked pretty carefully into it, and I think it's only a problem if you do a lot of chocolate. Like if you're doing, Rex, I think you said you're doing you like a double dose of cocoa powder every morning. So that's probably a significant amount. The cadmium is just naturally found in soils in the tropics. So that's, you know, you're going to get some of that all over the place. Like we already get cadmium every day in our grains and vegetables that we eat. But if you're eating a lot of dark chocolate, you might be doubling the amount you're getting every day. Cadmium isn't associated with any huge health concerns, unless you're like, you know, your farm is next to the battery facility. Yeah. But lead, like at any level, is a concern, and lead gets on. It doesn't get pulled into the trees, but lead is in the air, like air pollution, especially in the developing world around cities and roads, and it just settles on the beans when they're drying. So the best way to avoid lead in chocolate is to get chocolate that's coming from the rainforest, that's coming from a natural area. Probably going organic is a good way to go on that too.
Yeah. Rex, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, the book's out. What kind of response are you getting?
So far, huge. It turns out, you know, surprise, surprise, people are really interested in chocolate.
Well, I can see why, especially if they read your book. You know, I'm thinking of taking a copy of your book over to Gail Ambrosius. And
With my compliments.
I know Gail quite well. And I've talked with her many times, and I'm pretty sure that she would be interested in reading your book for sure. And several people are saying, what are the specific chocolate brands you recommend?
I go to Caputo's, and everything that's on there is you know, pre-approved for awesomeness, in all seriousness. There's one that I write about quite a bit in the book that I should recommend. Louisa Abram is the woman who makes the chocolate, and she's in Brazil, and she works only with purely wild cacao, and she makes a different bar from 7 different rivers in the Amazon in Brazil. So you get a completely different flavor from each, that's based on the cacao that's found on each river. And so, like, her story is a big part of the book, and I think many of her bars are available on the Caputo's website.
Well, this has been a lot of fun for me, and we did not even get into you landing in the in the jungle on an airstrip that was actually used by cocaine distributors, and that story. And you really bring to life what it's like for the farmers and what it's like for the people. And I learned so much. I was just so grateful that you wrote this book. Thank you so much, Rowan, for being with us today and for writing your book. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Larry. I really appreciate it.
Appreciate it very much. Rowan Jacobson, S-E-N, not S-O-N, like we often see here in Wisconsin, is the author, and his book titled Wild Chocolate, Across the Americas in Search of Cacao's Soul. Thanks to him, and thank you for listening. And, of course, always a big thanks to our producers, Clara Neipert and Joel Patnaud. Joel produced this specific show. Technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins. And our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening, and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.
WPR connects you to people in Wisconsin and around the world. You hear many perspectives and civil conversations every day, and you may even learn a few things along the way. Wisconsin Public Radio brings you thoughtful conversations and the latest news. Thanks for listening.
Support for WPR comes from the state of Wisconsin, business sponsors, and tens of thousands of supporters who contribute. Thank you to everyone who makes WPR possible on air, on the app, and at WPR.org.